The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick, and I'm so glad you were able to join me this evening. The way companies go about their philanthropy has evolved considerably over the past few decades, and a San Francisco-based company has had a significant influence on that transformation. It's Salesforce. And this evening, you will hear from Suzanne DiBianca, their Executive Vice President of Corporate Relations and Chief Philanthropy Officer.
The 1-1-1 model is 1% of time, equity, and profits delivered back to the community. And as you said, we've learned from the best. Cisco had an incredible product donation program, Hasbro, incredible volunteer program. And what we've realized, eBay on the equity side, you know, what we've realized is that all companies, no matter what you do or what size you are, have these assets. They all have people, they all have products, and they all have resources to some level.
And in survey after survey, you will find the most highly regarded non-governmental organization in the world is BRAC. And for those of you who are not familiar with them, you will be after you hear from Danella Rapier, the president and CEO of BRAC USA.
It's an interesting statistic because many, many people believe that poverty has actually gotten worse and that all of the work that's being done by poverty-fighting organizations like BRAC, that they haven't been making a difference. But it's actually quite the opposite. When you look at the statistics, this is the first time ever that the number of people who are in extreme poverty is below 10% in the world.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, March 11th. Say goodbye to pay-as-you-wish at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They are now charging a $25 admission to anyone outside the state, with the exception of students from New York, Connecticut, or New Jersey. Over the next 4 years, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation will steer $170 million to increase women's economic might across the world, delivering on Melinda Gates' longstanding goal to place greater emphasis on women's equality. Thomas L. Pearson and the Pearson Members Foundation is suing the University of Chicago for the return of $22.9 million, the amount given so far on a $100 million pledge made by the foundation to the school. Foundations have little racial or ethnic diversity on their boards, yet typically don't view that as troubling, this according to a report just put out by BoardSource. And finally, there was a huge burst of giving to causes that people felt were threatened by the Trump administration, commonly referred to as rage philanthropy. But according to a recent study by the National Research Group and PMX, that is burning out as both giving and advocacy for these causes has returned to around their pre-inauguration levels. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Suzanne DiBianca from Salesforce right after this.
I used to have more hair. I used to have more color. And I used to have cancer. I beat it. I did. Not alone. I used to have no idea what the American Cancer Society did. Research, yeah, but also free rides to chemo and free lodging near hospitals. I used to maybe give a little, then I got so much back. I used to have cancer.
Please give at cancer.org.
Babies sure don't come with manuals. And for their moms living in poverty, it can feel impossible to make ends meet. Thankfully, there's Nurse Family Partnership to help new moms be the best they can be. Their nurses are always there for moms throughout pregnancy and after the baby comes home. A mom can change her baby's world. Nurse Family Partnership can help guide her there. Join in changing the future for babies born into poverty. Visit supportnfp.org.
Youth opportunities, strong communities, a healthy planet. Sounds like the work of social entrepreneurs. Yes, but it's also the work of artists. Upstart CoLab is a new national collaboration connecting artists, impact investors, and social entrepreneurs. Upstart's mission is to create opportunities for artist innovators to deliver social impact at scale. Upstart is committed to promoting artists as innovators, unleashing capital for creativity, and enabling sustainable creative lives. Find out more at www.upstartco-lab.com.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
When people asked me who was going to be on the show this Sunday, and I told them Salesforce, the almost universal response was cool. Now, I don't hear that often, not about a guest on the show, or frankly, about much of anything else I might ever be doing. One of the things that has helped make Salesforce cool is that they have had philanthropy baked into their business model from the day they opened their doors. And the architect of that, along with their CEO, has been Suzanne DiBianca, the Executive Vice President of Corporate Relations and the Chief Philanthropy Officer of Salesforce, who is with us now. Good evening, Suzanne, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
For those who might not be familiar with Salesforce, beyond the name, tell us about what the company does.
Sure. The company is the world leader in intelligent customer relationship management enterprise software.
You know, and it's so interesting that you just mentioned that philanthropy was one of the founding tenets of the company. Now, most entrepreneurs are just consumed about making their organization a going concern, but this was really rare to do this at early and particularly back in 2000. What was the genesis of this, and what has been the impact of integrating philanthropy into the business model right from the very outset?
Yeah, thanks. When we started the company, we really had a principle that we sort of called the three-legged stool, which was a new software model, new model for technology, which essentially was software delivered in the cloud. Today, it's ubiquitous. In 2000, unheard of.
You're
still getting CDs in the mail from AOL and others. So the first tenet of our founding was around a new technology model. The second was around a new business model, which was subscription-based and pay-as-you-go, also unheard of at the time in software. And we really took on the sort of magazine model where you pay if you're satisfied.
Yeah.
And if you're enjoying it. So the new business model was really around subscription-based software. And the third real key tenet of the stool was a new philanthropy model. And it was start early, start young, bake it into the DNA of the company. And as you build your business, really look at how you can create a company that not only delivers customer value, but value to all stakeholders.
Mm-hmm. And an initiative that Salesforce has pioneered and which has really caught the imagination of so many companies, particularly startups, as you alluded to, is this 1-1-1 model. Some of the concepts borrowed from your good neighbors out there. What is the 1-1-1 model?
Sure. The 1-1-1 model is 1% of time, equity, and profits delivered back to the community. And as you said, we've learned from the best. Cisco had an incredible product donation program, Hasbro, incredible volunteer program. And what we've realized, eBay on the equity side, you know, what we've realized is that all companies, no matter what you do or what size you are, have these assets. They all have people, they all have products, and they all have resources to some level. So we've really decided to kind of smash them all together, mm-hmm. take a really integrated approach, and deliver that message forward so that any company, any CEO could really figure out, given their unique assets, how they could put them to good work in the world.
Now, when you first started the company and you had your IPO, did you have a foundation set up? I mean, did you have money foundation right from the outset?
Yeah, we did. We had a foundation set up very early on. It was a separate legal entity, and we actually sold some shares on the pre-IPO market as a way to generate cash before our IPO. And then as a result of our IPO, had a lot of cash that we were able to then give back in the form of grants.
Mm-hmm. And you said that 1% of the time of the employees can be dedicated as volunteer work to organizations. How many days a year is that? And how many of your employees partake in that program?
Yeah, we have an incredible participation rate. We're at about 85% of our employees
participate. Unheard of.
It's unheard of. I think the national average is around 20%.
Mm-hmm.
And two reasons for that. The first is that it's part of our new hire orientation program. So when you start with Salesforce, you get your laptop, you get your company messages, and then you're sent off to a soup kitchen or to do something good in the world. And we really want to make sure that our values come forward really quickly and you understand that we hope that it's a core part of your time with us as an employee.
Mm-hmm.
So partly that's why our participation rate is so high, is because we really bake it in on the first day of work. And yeah, secondly, the time that we give, if you actually do the math, it's 2% of work time. So it's 6 paid days. And we if people hit their max hours, they unlock more grant dollars that they can use for matching. So it's a real incentive to sort of get out, whether you're on the board of directors, whether you're a mentor, or whether you're just out, you know, in the park sort of cleaning it up on a lovely day with your team. All of it matters.
Yeah. Everything is aligned.
Everything's aligned.
You know, as a vehicle to encourage other companies to commit to this formula, you helped to found an organization called Pledge 1%. How many companies have joined in this effort by taking that pledge?
Pledge 1% is an initiative started by Salesforce, Atlassian, one of the companies that we work with pre-IPO, and also a small company called Rally Software out of Boulder, Colorado. And we just came together as an experiment to see if we put some structure around this 1-1-1 idea for other companies, how many would execute. With very little marketing and very small staff, in under a 3-year period, we're now at about 5,000 companies in 98 countries.
Congratulations.
And we've unlocked about $250 million in net new philanthropy dollars and over $1 billion, we believe, in product donation. So it's been an incredible ride. And I think that people that are starting companies today really understand that this is a core vehicle for attracting great talent and that their businesses can do more in the world than just sell widgets.
Yeah, and picking up on that a little bit, I mean, is there a quantifiable, real, and value to these companies for doing this?
I think that the value is in the culture.
Yeah.
And the value is in the employee attraction and retention rates. And lastly, also largely in the customer relationships. When you can align with customers on value, your relationship with them over time is super solid and can continue to grow.
And you're kind of hoping this becomes the new normal. I mean, you love to see Pledge 1% go away and just have this the way everybody does business when they start up a company.
That's right. So we've been working on what we call the kind of front end of the funnel, which is with a lot of the angel investors and also with the attorneys and the founders. So, you know, it's much easier to give a percentage of your company away when you own 100% and then you're left with 99%. Much harder when you're diluted through a bunch of venture investment dollars and you're sort of closing in on your Series C or D rounds. So we've been really focused on really early in the funnel, including it into term sheets in some cases and into founding documents and others.
Well, Salesforce is being used by more and more nonprofit organizations, of course, on the fundraising end of things, but increasingly for impact and evaluation of the organization's program. Starting with the latter, how are those tools being utilized for that kind of work?
Yeah, we have over 30,000 nonprofits that are using Salesforce technology for free or on a discounted rate. All nonprofits get Salesforce. If you're a C3 or a C3 equivalent globally, you get 10 licenses for free of Salesforce. And if you look at the bell curve of nonprofits in this country and really globally, most of them have operating budgets of less than $1 million. So, you know, majority percentage of the customers are fully donated. Fundraising, very analogous to sales management. So that is about how 50% of the customers are using Salesforce. And we have a product that makes it much easier and out of the box to turn that on. And program and evaluation also, because it's a really customizable platform. Just one example in that would be the American Red Cross. So the American Red Cross is managing volunteerism. In some cases, they're managing distribution of cots and resources so that they can look after a natural disaster to see how many volunteers they've mobilized, how many people gave blood, how many people gave other items, and, you know, how many blankets were used. And it actually really is a great way for them also to coordinate with their donors and their volunteers in a real-time way.
Oh, that's fantastic. And also to impact their work and what they're doing and what they could be doing better, so it works on all different counts.
That's right.
You know, as far as the fundraising is concerned, you have have now teamed up with the United Way and have launched a new app called Philanthropy Cloud. What will that do for corporate employees?
Yeah, thank you for the question. And .org is very excited about this, as are we all in the company.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, United Way, great institution, sorting out for themselves who they can be in the future, how to modernize their own operations, connect with younger donors. And, you know, one void we really saw in the market was this idea of having sort of a mobile passport for an individual as a community servant. And really what that looks like is, and for many, many years, United Way has had a lot of corporate partnerships. And they're really looking at, you know, how can they connect their corporations with great volunteerism locally? How can they begin to understand profile of people so they can sort of spoon feed them opportunities? So it's really a great partnership. And we're really going to be starting around volunteerism and giving, where, you know, you can, in partnership with United Way and Salesforce, if your corporation is a member of Philanthropy Cloud, you can really much more easily find volunteer opportunities that are suited to you, that are in your geography, that are in your areas of interest. And if you really think about it like a LinkedIn for philanthropy, sort of the ultimate mission, and really could take that profile with you.
That's fantastic. Let's turn to the grant-making side of the house. You were the executive director of the foundation, and now you're on the corporate side as the chief of philanthropy. You kind of describe your grant-making as a pyramid. Why don't you walk us through that pyramid?
Yeah, thank you. The pyramid and the way that it works today really is kind of in two parts. We had a middle layer around technology innovation, which has kind of now bled into both ends. But if you think about the bottom of the pyramid, these are what we call sort of citizen philanthropy grants.
Hmm.
And these are grants for our employees. They include everything from matching gifts to team grants to what we call champion grants, which are people that are in the top volunteerism rank, and we give $10,000 to them to thank them for their service and their hard work in the world.
So really democratic.
Really democratic. They can give to blood cancer. They can give to animal rights. You know, you name it. We don't in any way sort of target that from a from an industry perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that's really important because we do believe in part of working at Salesforce is getting sort of trained in who you can be as a citizen philanthropist throughout your career. So we want to empower people around that. And then the sort of top as you go up the pyramid is really around strategic grants. And the two areas that .org is very focused in today is around education and workforce development.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of workforce development, I know you partner with one of my favorite organizations, Year Up, but you also have something called VetForce, correct?
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we, you know, we've learned that the veterans coming home come with an incredible amount of leadership skills, teamwork skills, sort of baked into their experience in the field or in operations. And yet it's very hard for them to find civilian jobs often, and they don't know how to translate those skills into current market jobs. So we've been doing, and also, by the way, there's an incredibly high suicide rate around returning veterans. And largely what we found is that is largely based into the fact that they don't feel a sense of community anymore, and that jobs are very hard. And they come with a life insurance policy. And oftentimes for some of these men and women, they sort of feel like for their family when they're struggling for finding a job, that that life insurance policy is more valuable to their family than it is for them sort of hiking up a large hill around gaining new skills and sort of starting over in a civilian career. So we've really worked hard with a lot of veteran organizations to train them in technology skills through a tool that we call Trailhead. And it's not only a technology training and certification program, it's really a community program so that they can connect with one another, they can share ideas and opportunities. And we have a lot of our partners now in this community that are looking for great Salesforce admin that also have these leadership and teamwork skills. And so they, you know, they come not only with certification, but a big sense of community, teamwork, and leadership that we're then able to sort of place them within our customers and our partner ecosystem. So we have about 10,000 veterans that we've trained up today with the goal of tripling that in the next 2 years.
Fantastic. The company is also deeply committed, Suzanne, to the environment. And in that regard, you just keep on pushing yourself to move faster and faster and faster. What are some of your activities there and commitments you've made in that realm?
Yeah, I think this is another place that business is moving faster than government.
Oh,
I
yeah.
I think the capital markets, look at Tesla, look at some other examples, especially when this country pulled out of Paris. I think the business community rallied, as did often cities, which it's been great to watch. But we realized we needed to go faster. And so we had a commitment around being a net zero company by 2050. We accelerated that by 33 years, and we've been investing in
already happened then, right?
Yeah.
Invested
in all kinds of great projects. We will be renewable, fully powered by mm-hmm. renewable energy. We've been investing in wind farms and solar farms. And then we're really looking at we're looking all across our business, our supply chain, how we're investing in various investment tools, and are we doing enough in green bonds, et cetera. And then, you know, we're looking a lot at real estate. So we've just built the Salesforce Tower in San Francisco. We have towers in New York and London. And we're really looking at how can those buildings be best in class from a sustainability perspective.
All across the board.
All across the
board. Talk a little bit more about your impact investing. That falls under your jurisdiction. What are you looking at? What are the kind of things are you investing in?
Yes, I think you'll see thematically with Salesforce is we don't like to have philanthropy off to the side. We believe that philanthropy is part of everyone's job and every different business that we run. And as it relates to investing, you know, Salesforce is the third most active corporate investor on the planet.
Hmm.
We've got about $500 million off the balance sheet. We really looked at if we were to take that venture arm and target a fund around entrepreneurs that were developing solutions in the areas of sustainability, workforce development, education, diversity, and inclusion, could we find great entrepreneurs in the enterprise software space? Lo and behold, incredible entrepreneurs have emerged. We've been able to invest. It's a $50 million fund. We've only been at it for less than a year, and we've got about $15 million out the door, 11 great entrepreneurs. And so far, the fund, we put a gender and equality lens on it and is 70% women and minorities.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really proud of that.
I bet you are. How does a company look at political issues? I mean, clearly, this is a pretty dicey environment in which we're in. You have customers of all political stripes. But by the same token, you have core principles around the company of which equality is one. How do you kind of think about that, and how do you address that topic?
Yeah, not only do we have customers that cross the spectrum from a political affiliation, we also have employees that cross the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So we stand for equality for all, and we stand for trust. And these are two of our top values. And so, you know, we are not in the game of politics, but we do believe that all people deserve to have equal opportunity, equal access, equal pay, and equal education. So it's really those four pillars that define what we get involved in as it relates to sort of social and governmental issues. I talked about pulling out of the Paris Agreement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we essentially just went faster with our own programs as a result versus taking any major political point of view about it. As it relates to LGBT rights, you know, we did go to bat on that one as it related to some laws that have been introduced, largely just because we believe that everyone deserves to be treated equally, no matter your religious affiliation, no matter your sexual orientation. So, you know, we really listen to our employees
mm-hmm.
and what they believe, and we really follow their passion.
You know, we had Shamina Singh, who's the president of the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth, on the program a couple months ago, and she spoke about the data divide, a concern that they have that there's a gulf between data, the way it's used in business, and the way it's used in the social sector, and they started something up called data philanthropy. I know that Salesforce is on the front lines of that effort, but how serious do you think it is, this data divide, and what do nonprofits need to do?
Yeah, the data divide is real. It's also an overall, I think it's a current iteration of the starving of infrastructure investments that nonprofits have always struggled with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that now, because everything and, well, so many things can be delivered on a mobile device as it relates to social services and transparency and tracking the people or issues that you serve, I think the biggest thing that I'm seeing right now is even that people are gathering data, they don't quite know what to do with it. So I've been working a lot in the area of artificial intelligence, and we have a great product, Einstein, and we're really working to make our CRM smarter for our customers so that they can gain insights on these massive data stores in a way that can really sort of drive their programs further. But it's real. It's hard to hire data scientists as an NGO when the competitive pay rates for those people are massive. It's not a new problem in the nonprofit sector, but I think it's the divide is getting wider.
Yeah. And I think what you sort of said at the very outset of that, in terms of the starvation cycle, is that technology has always been looked upon as overhead.
That's right.
For nonprofits, and that has to change.
That's right. And I think it is changing. In fact, I was with an executive director of a large NGO the other day, and we were talking about a proposal they had on serving. They do international development work and built a really cool app on an Android device and able to get much better real-time data. You know, they were talking about how to position the proposal from a technology perspective, and I said, don't make it a technology proposal, make it a program proposal.
Yeah, good and advice. Great advice.
Embed the technology within it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. As we said, you were one of the first companies that philanthropy was integrated into the business model. Tell us a little bit more about what is the corporate culture like at Salesforce, and what do you think the impact of philanthropy has been on that culture?
I think the impact of philanthropy has been massive on our culture because you're really able to both bring your whole self to work, but also gain some perspective about sort of where your life is in compared to others. So it brings us a sense of humility, a massive sense of sort of gratitude and generosity. And, you know, we are a culture that is sort of founded on our values around equality and trust and leadership and teamwork. And so I really believe that the philanthropy had a critical role in that because also it got people out of their own swim lanes so that early on when you're out at a volunteer event, you're meeting people in engineering and marketing and finance and able to work together and in different capacities when you go back to the office, but in a way that has you, you know, coming from a relationship that was grounded in something good in the world.
Mm-hmm. Let me close with this, Suzanne. And I want to go back to the beginning of our conversation and the 1-1-1 model, because that's a pretty neat idea, but it sounds a little daunting. It sounds a little complicated. Sure, a company like Salesforce can do it, but it just sounds a little bit beyond maybe the average startup. Try to dispel that for us if you could.
Yeah, thanks for the question. It's very easy as a early stage founder to just take a small percentage of your equity and put it aside for the community so that when you have a liquidity event in the future, it's there. You don't have to do anything other than move it. Early on through a very simple form, you can find out more about that on pledge1%.org. We've got all these warrant transfer agreements and a whole bunch of policy statements up there that you can repurpose in your own organization. But it's a very easy thing to do as a startup founder, and it's something that I don't think I've ever met anyone who has regretted doing it.
Yeah, and it's hard to do when you're out 10 years.
That's right.
A completely different effect when you do it from the day you open up your doors.
That's right.
Well, Suzanne DiBianca, the Executive Vice President of Corporate Relations and Chief Philanthropy Officer of Salesforce, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. If anyone listening wants to learn more about Salesforce's programs and products for nonprofits, where can they go to get that information?
Absolutely. You should visit www.salesforce.org, which will tell you everything about how to get started on the platform and our strategic grants and our volunteer opportunities.
And for the 1% pledge, it's pledge1%.org, and that's one with the numeral one, correct?
That's correct.
Thanks, Suzanne. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks. It was a delight being here.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
You probably know Sesame Street as the TV show that taught you letters and numbers. But Sesame is so much more. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit with a mission to help all children grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. Big Bird wants to help, so he started the Yellow Feather Fund to bring education to children in need. You can help too. Visit yellowfeatherfund.org to learn more or make a donation. That's yellowfeatherfund.org.
With nearly one in four New Yorkers struggling to meet their most basic needs, we know our city is facing a crisis. But did you know that our highest poverty rates are among women and mothers? These women don't need handouts. They need a hand up. That's why Grameen America provides tens of thousands of women across our city with the loan capital they need to start their own small businesses. With the gift of entrepreneurship, these women have the opportunity to escape poverty, provide for their children, and gain independence. Join the movement today. Invest in New York City by investing in them. Visit GrameenAmerica.org to learn more.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting benetech.org.
Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
The largest non-governmental organization in the world, with well over 100,000 employees, is BRAC. And the NGO Advisor, which ranks these organizations, has placed BRAC at the very top of the heap, rated number one for 2 years in a row. So if you're not familiar with them, this is a splendid opportunity to become so. And we'll do that now, courtesy of Danella Rapier, the president and CEO of BRAC USA. Good evening, Danella, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having me, Denver.
BRAC was founded in Bangladesh in 1972. Tell us about the organization and of its mission and purpose.
Sure. Nick Kristof from the New York Times once described BRAC as the best aid organization that you've never heard of, so I'm delighted to have the opportunity to tell you a little bit more about us. So BRAC is a global development and humanitarian organization. We're one of the largest in the world. Our programs reach over 120 million people worldwide. We're unusual in that we're the only NGO of our scale that was founded in the global south in a poor country as opposed to being founded in the wealthier north in the U.S. or U.K. or Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Our work currently spans about 11 countries, including Bangladesh, where BRAC was founded, and where our programs reach across the entire country.
And as for BRAC USA, how do you relate to the international organization, and what is your specific charge?
Yes, sure. BRAC USA is the North American affiliate for BRAC. We were founded when BRAC decided to go international and when it decided to go beyond the borders of Bangladesh and began working in Afghanistan and then Pakistan and now in places like Liberia, Sierra Leone, and others. BRAC USA was founded in order to really spread the word about BRAC and also to help mobilize resources to support the programs. There's also BRAC UK, mm-hmm. which is located in London, that covers the UK and Europe.
So, Danella, how is poverty defined by the international organizations such as the United Nations or the World Bank? Where's that line? And what kind of progress is the global community making in lifting people out of poverty?
It's an interesting statistic because many, many people believe that poverty has actually gotten worse and that all of the work that's being done by poverty-fighting organizations like BRAC, that they haven't been making a difference. But it's actually quite the opposite. Hmm. When you look at the statistics, this is the first time ever that the number of people who are in extreme poverty is below 10% in the world. So that's and poverty is defined as $1.90 a day, which is a very low amount. Now, that's still 700 million people, and it's still we have to address the fact that 700 million people in the world are living on less than $1.90 a day. And even that misstates what's happening because a lot of these people, they make all of their money just once a year at the harvest, and they have to live off of that all year round. So it's not like they're getting $1.90 every single day. When you're living in poverty, your money comes in very lumpy, and so it makes their financial lives really, really difficult.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, one of the ways these people have been lifted out of poverty has been through microfinance. Mm-hmm. And you certainly are familiar with microfinance,
yes.
Not only with your work at BRAC, but with Axion, where you were before you came to BRAC. First, give us a brief description of what microfinance is, and then of its impact. You know, it has many, many advocates, but there are a few detractors as well as to its effectiveness.
Microfinance has made a huge difference. It's and one of the things I often say to people when they are trying to understand microfinance is there isn't a developed economy in the world that doesn't have a financial system underlying it. And so microfinance really is financial services for poor people. The reason that it's so difficult to do is because even in this country, in the U.S., the banks, in order to be efficient, they tend to lend money in big chunks, whereas people who are living in poverty like the average loans are something like $100. It's also very labor intensive because a loan officer has to, you know, reach people who don't have access to financial service like we do here. And it's hard to believe when you're sitting here in a country where there's a bank on every corner and an ATM everywhere and you have, you know, five credit card offers a month showing up in your mailbox. But a huge amount of people in the world, something like 2 billion people, have no access to a bank. They have no way to save money in a bank. Mm-hmm. They have no way to borrow money for any kind of equipment for their business or buy in bulk for their businesses to save on costs. So microfinance actually provides a really, really important service for people living in poverty.
You know, BRAC has taken a very disruptive approach to the plight of poverty, and your unique response has led to the creation of something called the graduation approach. Walk us through that, Danella, if you would.
Sure. The graduation program was created because after years and years of doing microfinance and seeing the benefits that it brought to people, BRAC realized that it wasn't reaching the very, very poorest because there is a level of people who a small loan is just not going to be enough to help them pull themselves out of poverty. So BRAC pioneered a program that is, as you say, called the graduation program. It's designed to graduate from extreme poverty into a sustainable livelihood. So many of these people would still be living in what we would consider to be poverty, but they have a way to sustain their life and they're no longer destitute. So the program is a multidimensional program designed just for people in that situation. It starts with some very basic things like healthcare, nutrition training, a consumption stipend so that all of their anything that they're doing doesn't go to consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And then the transfer of some sort of a protective asset, something like a cow or goats or chickens.
Yeah.
And then over a 2-year period, they're coached on how to build a business around that asset. And they also get training in financial literacy and in running the business and in different kinds of livelihoods. And then in order to graduate from the program, you need to meet certain criteria. So you need to have multiple sources of income, eat at least twice a day, your children being in school, you have sanitation facilities available to you. So there are a number of criteria they have to meet. And this program, we've 1.7 million households have gone through it to date. So that's reached a tremendous number of people. And the amazing thing is that even when you go back 7 or 8 years later, you find that the women are still on a positive upward economic trajectory. So it's been a very durable program as well.
Yeah, and remarkably holistic. You know, I was really struck by the coaching and understanding
yes.
that a lot of these women have low self-esteem
right.
and really need to work through it. So you've really looked at this from a multifaceted perspective.
Yes, and it's an interesting thing when you meet with the women who've gone through the program, when you ask them things like, what's the most important change that this has made for you? And a lot of them will say things like, I get invited to parties now.
Yeah.
I'm suddenly part of the community where I wasn't before.
Yeah.
I get invited to birthday parties and weddings. And it's hard to imagine that before, that even in places like this, they were almost just ostracized from their communities.
Well, they had no money and probably people thought they were going to be asked to give them something.
Right,
so they were just
right.
not included and they had mm-hmm. very few friendships as a result. Give us an overview of BRAC's social enterprise efforts and the role they play in supporting the mission of the organization.
This is another area where I think BRAC is really quite unique. BRAC self-generates about 3/4 of its own budget, which is about $1 billion. And as you can imagine, $1 billion in the places where we work goes really far.
Mm-hmm.
The social businesses are each designed around a particular problem of poverty, but is designed to be self-sustainable and in many cases even kick off a profit. So, for example, after years of microfinance, there were a number of women in the rural areas who had a little bit more wealth. They had healthier cows. The cows were producing excess milk. They had nowhere to sell it. So our founder, Sir Abed, he looked at this problem and said, gee, they're selling milk for really very little in the rural areas, and they don't have enough don't have a market for it. And in DACA in the capital city, I'm paying a lot more. Why don't we set up a dairy in between? And so the dairy was set up, and it buys milk from all these poor women farmers and set up these chilling plants all over the country, and then sells the now a range of dairy products into DACA. And what's been interesting is that not only has the dairy been successful and is actually generates a very nice profit, it's actually driven the demand for dairy products. And now there's a lot of competition in dairy in Bangladesh. So it's actually been a really, really positive thing thing for the country and for the women. Similarly, we have a retail chain called Erong, and it's our most successful social enterprise. And similarly, we source all of the product from women who live in the rural parts of the country or other parts where they're much more in poverty. And again, where they had no market for selling their products. So we buy from, you know, women artisans, and and they sell saris and have different, you know, some beautiful like handbags and blankets and crafts, anything that you could want. Everybody who goes to DACA goes to Erong.
Yeah. Well, they've made a mark on the fashion industry. And I think another wonderful thing that BRAC does here is that you pay these artisans and producers upon delivery. They don't have to wait until the sale. And that makes a big difference in somebody trying to run their household.
Yes. So many of them otherwise have to sell on consignment and only get their money late. And so, that is a huge advantage for selling your products to Erong.
You know, being a pioneer in this realm of social enterprise, I know how hard it is. This is not easy stuff. What are the keys to doing it right?
I think some of the keys are probably the most important one is looking for those market gaps and really figuring out what the right solution is. And as with everything else that BRAC does, we've always taken a very business-minded approach and have really, really focused on trying something out in a small pilot to begin with, and pilot, drive the cost down, figure out the best way to do it, really do research and understand how it is working, and then scaling it up big. Our founder often says, small is beautiful, but scale is necessary. So we're very focused on taking these and really scaling them up. But I think taking that, you know, that hard-edge business-minded approach has been really helpful for BRAC.
As you mentioned a few moments ago, BRAC works in 11 countries with a breadth of things that you would do. But in order to bring this home, let's focus on just one if we could. And that would be the roughly 700,000 Myanmar nationals that have entered into Bangladesh since late summer. What's the present situation, and what is BRAC doing to help address this crisis?
Yes, it's just a horrific situation, what the Rohingya people have gone through in Myanmar. And this is not a new problem, but the level of atrocities is really, it's just horrible. This is not a new situation either. There were already roughly about 300,000 Rohingya living as refugees in Bangladesh, in Bangladesh, which is right. There's a very small border between the two countries, but they've come across the border. So there were already a number of people living there, and then another, close to 700,000 have come across since. So it's about a million people who are there in a community of only about 300,000 people of the Bangladeshis. I was just there in late January, and I have seen poverty before, and I've seen pretty destitute places. And this really, I mean, it takes your breath away just how dense it is. It's a hilly area. Like half of them are children. When we got out of our cars, there were hundreds of children, just no parents anywhere around, but, you know, running around. And what they've gone through is really, really terrible. So what BRAC is doing there now is we have done everything from drilling wells for clean water. We've set up sanitation facilities. We have child-friendly spaces. We work a lot with the adolescent girls and the women. Refugee areas are places where human trafficking is often target. So we're really focused on protection for, particularly for the children and the young girls. And we deliver health care as well. So we're doing quite a lot there. As an organization, a Bangladeshi organization, of course, we're easily the largest responding organization. And of course, we'll be there for the long haul because we feel that this problem is not not an easy one to solve.
Well, no, it's a tragic humanitarian crisis for sure. Much of the funding for humanitarian and development work has traditionally come from donor agencies in the U.S. and the U.K. and Australia. But some of that funding is now going elsewhere as these donors are targeting it for more strategic purposes. So what kind of things is BRAC doing to remain financially sustainable while also keeping your eye on the mission and purpose of the organization?
Yes, it's a very, very good question, and it's a very interesting time for BRAC. We've been very successful in Bangladesh, and Bangladesh itself has been very successful. So it's actually achieving middle-income status, though it's still at the low end of that echelon. But it's done quite well for itself and much better than many of the countries who were also founded around the same time. Many in Africa, if you look at the human indicators, many of the countries that were founded, you know, roughly 50-ish years ago, still fare far worse off than Bangladesh, in spite of Bangladesh still dealing with a lot of the challenges of its geography, its size. I think people don't realize just how populous it is. It's the eighth most populous country in the world.
Yeah.
It's a little light, but it's tiny. Geographically, it's very small. And so it's kind of like taking half of the population of the United States and putting them all in the state of Louisiana. It's something of that nature.
Wow.
But Bangladesh has you know, largely, I think BRAC has played a huge role in how well it's done for its poor people. And as a result, the donor organizations are turning their attention elsewhere to other places that are in deeper poverty, understandably. And so BRAC has been very focused on making sure that we take that 75% self-sustaining to internally generated to a higher number. So we're looking at a lot of the programs that we currently have traditionally run that no longer really, that in a lot of cases the government now is able to provide. For instance, we have about 1 million children in our primary schools in Bangladesh and in our other countries. And gradually, because for a long time, government wasn't able to get out to the rural areas. So BRAC really filled a gap there for the poor rural areas. And so, but now the government is actually able to get out there, and the government has adopted BRAC's model in many ways. And so that's something that we'll be doing less of as the government picks up more of that. And so we're looking more and more at ways to generate funding from other sources and make our programs more self-sustaining, like the education program or healthcare, where now that people have more disposable income, they actually are able to pay a little bit for school fees, or they are able to pay a little bit for their health care. So we're doing a lot of that with just our core programs, thinking about, are there ways that we can make them not profit-driving, but self-sustaining.
Well, a bit of a paradigm shift when you take your recipients and you turn some of them into customers.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Development used to be more of a wholesale industry. But because of organizations like BRAC, it's becoming more retail, much more customer-centric. I think your graduation program would be evidence of that. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, how is digital technology changing the way that BRAC goes about doing its work?
Digital has changed things a fair amount, not as much as I expect will happen over the next 5 to 10 years. BRAC has the largest mobile money application. Actually, there are two really large players in this, M-Pesa, which is in Kenya and Tanzania, some other places now, and BRAC, which is Bcash, B capital K A S H, and Bcash is a mobile money platform, and it's been highly successful. And it makes it much, much easier for people in, you know, it's basically transferring money over their phones so that they don't have to leave their business, close up for the day, and go down to the bank to pay their loan payment. It saves them time and effort. So that technology, in fact, I was surprised to see that even in the refugee camps, that there already are Bcash in there, which was kind of amazing, since it only really, they've only grown so much since last August. So that technology has changed the way people's lives are in Bangladesh. There are still a number of things like that that we can do in our other countries. The microfinance programs in our other countries aren't yet as digital as they are in Bangladesh or in other places. So I think that's still to come. And similarly, our education programs, we know that there's a lot that we could do with technology and education, but that is only just now beginning.
You know, BRAC doesn't do all of this alone. You do it through collaborations and partnerships with governments and other NGOs and donors. Do you have an overarching philosophy that guides these collaborations?
I don't know whether we have an overarching philosophy so much as we partner with a number of organizations, and in fact, working with governments is actually core to what we do, because it's only really governments that can really, really, really truly do things at scale and can take programs and make sure that they can be common throughout the countries. So we work particularly in the countries that we work in Africa and in other parts of Asia. We work very, very closely with the governments. And in Bangladesh, it's at a high point, I think, in terms of the relationship between BRAC and the government, particularly since we founded BRAC University.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have a university that in and of itself, because the BRAC University has a very strong relationship with the government. The government sends a number of their civil servants through the program. So in terms of other partners, we partner with other NGOs. Certainly the donor agencies that have been our biggest partners lately have been the UK government,
yep,
DFID, and Australian Aid, which is now called DFAT.
Mm-hmm.
That they are huge partners for us, and they have provided considerable amount of funding, and they have been fabulous in giving BRAC discretion in ways in order to do some of the innovations and make sure that the programs can be long-term.
That's great. You guys have a very well-earned reputation of being an exceptionally well-managed organization. In fact, there are case studies about BRAC at the Harvard Business School, an institution that I know that you are most familiar with.
That's right.
One of those areas where BRAC truly shines is in the science of delivery, the efficient delivery of services to people in need. How do you do that so well?
I think it's the philosophy that imbues the entire organization in terms of the service delivery being focused first and foremost and always on the beneficiary. And as you said, increasingly they're becoming customers, clients.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a really big focus on that. And there's a really big focus on measuring what's being done and seeing what works and finding ways to be doing continuous improvement.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your personal journey, Janella, to becoming the CEO of BRAC USA, and what are proving to be some of the more valuable experiences you've had that are helping you now in your current role.
Sure. I'd say if you look at my history, I started out in accounting and finance, and I would never at that time have imagined that I would be in a role like this. After 6 years at Price Waterhouse, I had decided to go to business school. I was fortunate enough to be a recipient of a scholarship program, Price Waterhouse, so they essentially put me through Harvard Business School. And then I was an indentured servant for a few years after that, when I then decided to go work at HBS. I became the CFO there. And after about 5 years there, the dean of the school basically asked me to go from the expense side to the revenue side. And he had seen that I always really enjoyed working with the alums and doing the presentations about our finances and getting to know them. And so he asked me to take on the fundraising for the school. And so I ran the first ever HBS campaign, which was an enormous success. A lot of things came together between the dean's vision, the senior associate dean who was the road warrior, big gift getter, Howard Stevenson, and then me managing the group, that it all really came together. And it was so successful that then President Larry Summers asked me to move over to the university side, and I became the vice president for alumni affairs and development. And I did that for several years. And after he left Harvard, I decided that I really wanted to do something really, really impactful and really focused on poverty. I had always been really interested in that and was fortunate that Partners in Health, Dr. Paul Farmer's organization, made the bold move of hiring me because coming from the wealthiest nonprofit in the world, except maybe for the Vatican, going to a scrappy NGO like Partners in Health was was a big change, but it was exactly what I was looking for.
Yeah.
And at the time, Partners in Health was pretty small, so I was there for the huge amount of growth of Partners in Health, which is an amazing healthcare organization. And I was then convinced to move over to Axione, where I was for several years, which is a very large microfinance network, and got to know BRAC through that. I visited Bangladesh for a microfinance retreat and was so blown away by how amazing BRAC is. And fortunately, when I came back, an executive recruiter reached out to me and she said, you know, they're looking for a CEO at BRAC USA. And it's a wonderful one. It's an amazing organization, and it is actually interesting how I often say that I call almost as much on what I know from my work at Harvard than at the other two NGOs that I worked in, because BRAC is large, and because that's and Harvard is large, and working across a large organization, it has a lot of this, a lot of similar elements.
Oh, your founder is going to make you work at scale no matter what.
So you exactly.
You got to think large. Tell us a little bit about the corporate culture. You know, you don't become the most highly regarded NGO in the world without having an exceptional culture where people can get wonderful stuff done. Tell us about it.
Sure. Yeah. BRAC USA itself is a smallish team, relatively speaking, to BRAC. We're about 25 people, and it's a really high-performing, high-energy, super motivated, talented group of people that are really, you know, one of my challenges is to keep people from working too much because they're just so driven. And we then work with all of the BRAC International countries, with the country heads directly, and then also with the leadership team in BRAC. And I think the BRAC itself is quite an interesting experience. It's in a 20-story building that was put up when there was nothing there. And after that, the largest slum in all of Dhaka basically ended up being right nearby. So you never forget who you're working for, because when you look out the window, you can see them. And it's the culture there is also, I think, one of being very, as I mentioned before, very business-minded, really trying to understand what works, why it works, and then trying to scale.
Let me close with this, Danella. BRAC has had an extraordinary influence in this entire field of development, as I think we have spoken about. So many of the innovations that were pioneered by BRAC have now really been replicated by one organization or another. So with that being said, and perhaps in the context of some of the things you're currently working on now, where do you see this field going and evolving over the course of the next 5 or 10 years?
It's an interesting question, and it will be interesting to see what happens over the next 5 to 10 years. For sure, I think there will be more and more social enterprise initiatives. Harvard Business School, my alma mater, as you mentioned, which actually has several case studies on BRAC. When I was a student there, there were no courses on doing business at the base of the pyramid, and now there are three full sections are oversold every year. So there's a focus even at places like Harvard Business School, which has been dubbed the West Point of capitalism, where they're actually focusing on what are we doing for business at the base of the pyramid. And there's a tremendous amount of interest. I'm so impressed by the younger generation now. There's so much energy around really trying to make this world a better place and really trying to eradicate poverty. And so I think that business-mindedness and the social enterprises, I think, is definitely a current wave and will continue to be a growing wave in the future. There also has been a huge movement around impact investing where investors are interested not just in making returns, but they're also interested in making the world a better place. So that, I think, also is pushing in that direction of of really seeing the world, seeing some of these countries not just as places for aid, but seeing them as markets. Mm-hmm. And there are some huge it's actually a huge failure of the capital markets that there are 2 billion people without financial services. there is a huge market potential there. So I think those are some of the things. And I think the aid, I think we will probably see a continuing decline in the traditional kinds of aid. I mean, we're seeing that already. And so and meanwhile, there is a whole new group of very wealthy individuals who are putting a lot of their attention on this. Bill Gates and Bill and Melinda Gates being the poster children for this.
For sure.
There are many people like that, and maybe not at that scale, not now, but maybe later, that are really focused on this as well. So I think that'll be a continuing trend, that some of it may be funded, some of the innovation may be funded more by individuals than by the traditional aid agencies in the future. The other thing is that I think there's been a real recognition recently that you need to strengthen the systems and the governments themselves. So partnerships with governments and strengthening governments, which is very hard to do, is, I think, something else that will continue as a trend into the future.
Lots to be done, but a very promising time at the same time. Well, Daniela Rapier, the president and CEO of BRAC USA, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and the kind of information visitors will find if they should go there.
Yes, BRACUSA.org. We have all of the information about our programs and about all of the countries where we work. So please do visit BRACUSA.org.
And support your work if they are so inclined.
And support our work. We are aiming to mobilize resources to support the great work that's being done in these countries. So, yes, we would be most, most grateful for support.
Well, thanks, Daniela. It was a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And that is this week's show. Next week, you will hear from Chuck Slaughter, the founder and CEO of Living Goods, whose goal is to build a sustainable distribution platform for products designed to fight poverty and disease in the developing world. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.